And therefore, the activity of the natural potassium is about 31 becquerels per gram, meaning that in 1 gram of the element, about 31 atoms will decay per second. Plants naturally contain other radioactive isotopes, such as carbon-14, but their contribution to the total activity is much smaller. Since a typical banana contains about 0.5 gram of potassium, it will have an activity of roughly 15 becquerels. Although the amount in a single banana is small, in environmental and medical terms, the radioactivity from a truckload of bananas is capable of causing a false alarm when passed through a radiation portal monitor used to detect possible smuggling of nuclear material at U.S. ports. And, for example, you can find a comment at Forbes.com that says, "There's much screaming and shouting from the usual suspects about the new radiation leak discovered at Fukushima, the stricken nuclear power plants in Japan. What they're not telling you is that the radiation leakage is about the same as 76 million bananas, a fact which should help put it all in some perspective." The banana equivalent dose. Well, here's what my Geiger counter sounds like when I'm measuring ambient radioactivity. Like right now, there's a few ticks, little bitty ticks. And here's what it sounds like when I approach it with a banana. Yeah, because the banana equivalent dose is a load of crap. I want to quote a Green Road on blogspot.com, which really hits the nail on the head about this. They compare the bananas with cesium. Cesium is a deadly poison. At the atomic or molecular level, the radioactivity of cesium is millions of times greater than that of some natural isotopes in the environment, such as potassium-40. The amount of potassium-40 on this planet never changes. Potassium-40 is a primordial element, and the radioactive portion of it won't change no matter what. Potassium and potassium-40 is present in some amount in most foods, and in large amounts in a few foods, such as bananas. Humans have dealt with this since the beginning of time. For us here on Earth, you cannot build up a toxic or hazardous level of potassium from eating an average amount of bananas. Although anything, including water, is dangerous, as it can be deadly if too much is taken in for too long in too large a quantity. The problems all start when the person absorbs radioactive cesium instead of potassium. If potassium in a banana or a fish gets replaced by the potassium mimic and poisonous cesium, that threatens health, even in low quantities such as a 10 to 50 becquerels per kilogram inside the body. Cesium mimics potassium in the body. Which would you rather have inside you if you had a choice? If potassium could be compared to a stick of dynamite, then cesium would be a huge bomb that would wipe out a large city like New York City. A banana has around 14 becquerels per second. 14 becquerels per banana consumed, based on information provided by Chiquita Bananas. They base this fact on how much potassium is in the banana. The counts per minute would be 840. When I tell you that, there's more information on that in just a moment. Radioactive potassium emits radiation, but there's a huge difference between the radiation intensity between potassium-40 in a banana and in man-made radioactive cesium. 20 tons of bananas is roughly, and before I get into more from this this site, a Green Road, that's 840 alpha hits per minute. And 20 tons of bananas is roughly equivalent to the radiation from 2 grams of cesium. Let me say that again. 20 tons of bananas is roughly equivalent to the radiation from 2 grams of radioactive cesium, which is contained in something the size of a dime. By comparison, ask yourself, how long would it take you to eat 20 tons of bananas? And by comparison, how long would it take to ingest 2 grams of cesium from a nuclear accident? It's fairly easy to swallow a dime-sized object. It's impossible to eat 20 tons of banana in one sitting. The problem with this very rough comparison is that if you spread 20 tons of bananas across a mile of land, it would just rot and decompose away harmlessly. But if you spread 2 grams of cesium equally across a mile of land, you cannot grow anything there for 1,000 years. You have just permanently radioactively contaminated that land with dangerous amounts of radioactive cesium. Genetically, humans, animals, and plants have adapted to solar radiation, plus all natural background radiation, including potassium, which, and departing from the text, as I mentioned a moment ago, is a mild alpha. Returning to the text, all living beings have evolved in this environment, so we all have repair mechanisms in our DNA to handle the small amount of low-activity natural radiation and the small amount of genetic damage this causes, and the radiation does cause damage. However, there's a huge difference between the potassium in a banana, natural solar radiation, and the radioactive cesium, iodine, or 1,200 other man-made but invisible radioactive contaminants found in food, soil, water, plants, animals, and humans thrown out of a reactor after a nuclear accident. And there's more at that link. And if you want to find that, look up at greenroad.blogspot.com. Maybe it'd be easier to find it with a search for cesium and bananas. And then you can find that comparison. The fact is, as I've said before, the radioactive emissions from the powerful elements that are used to boil water in reactors, the stupidest way to boil water I can possibly think of in a biosphere, is orders of magnitude greater than the radioactivity in a banana, and there is no comparison. The banana equivalent dose is a fraud. It's used to fool you. That's all it's good for. It is scientific bunk, anti-scientific bunk. Don't believe the banana equivalent dose, ever. Don't accept that. And now from BBC... The likely scale of the radioactive plume of water from Fukushima due to hit the west coast of North America, that's us, should be known sometime in April. Only minute traces of pollution from the beleaguered Japanese power plant have so far been recorded in Canadian continental waters. This will increase as contaminants disperse eastwards on Pacific currents. But scientists stress that even the peak measurements will be well within the limits set by safety authorities. Remember what I just said about the bananas. Returning to the BBC, since the 2011 Fukushima accident, researchers from the Bedford Institute of Oceanography have been sampling waters along a line running almost 2,000 kilometers due west of Vancouver, British Columbia, and by June of last year, they were detecting quantities of radioactive cesium and 137 and 134 along the sampling line's entire length. And there's more on that at bbc.com under the Science and Environment News. The U.S. government is not measuring radioactivity on the Pacific shore. Incredible, isn't it? Because whereas the levels that are just now arriving are going to be very small before they get somewhat larger, they will, of course, be concentrated in bioaccumulation by various sea animals. Cesium has already showed up in Pacific kelp, and it will accumulate in clams and crabs and other seafood, because, as I mentioned before, the cesium mimics potassium and the sea animals take it up. So when you get around to eating something that has been taking up cesium for a while, you're going to get a higher dose than you're going to get by walking down the beach. And that's why it's significant, and that's why the U.S. government should measure radioactivity on the Pacific shore, but it is not. And that is, of course, in collaboration with the nuclear industry's longstanding habit of relying on bunk, like the banana equivalent dose, and on the invisibility of radioactivity. Invisibility of radioactivity is just even better for the nuke industry when no one measures it at all. However, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is creating data using public volunteers. Here's a quote from their website. Models of ocean currents and cesium transport predict that the cesium plume will arrive along the northern sections of North American Pacific Coast, Alaska, and northern British Columbia sometime in the spring of 2014, and will arrive along the Washington, Oregon, and California coastline over the coming 1 to 2 years. The timing and pattern of dispersal underscores the need for samples further to the north and for additional samples to be collected every few months at sites up and down the coast, end quote. Now that is from this website, ourradioactiveocean.org. And on that website, you can volunteer. And when I looked at their map, it would appear that there is a dearth of volunteers from Oregon. So I'm asking you, the KBOO audience, you right now, please, if you think you can do this, please look up ourradioactiveocean.org and consider volunteering. This would be a matter of going down to the coast and collecting cubic meters of seawater, as easy as that, and sending it to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. That's ourradioactiveocean.org. And that's because, as I said, this stuff is going to bioaccumulate, and then it's going to bioaccumulate up our food chain and into our gut, and cesium will accumulate in our hearts. That's the nature of cesium. And it's not just cesium. That's just one indicator. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute is looking for one particular isotope of cesium because it will be a marker that will show that it came from the nuclear power plants instead of from atmospheric testing so many years ago. Ourradioactiveocean.org. And it's too bad no one's looking for the strontium and the uranium and the plutonium. And it's especially bad when you think that there is and must be and will be uranium, because it, as I've mentioned before, from research by the scientist Chris Busby in Britain, it coats DNA, and it is that thereby not only makes it more dangerous to DNA, but it allows other radioactivity to reflect into DNA. And it's extremely bad news that this stuff is coming our way. And it's also good news that it's not here yet. So, you know, enjoy yourself a crab and volunteer, please, at ourradioactiveocean.org. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell from KOMO News. There are significant construction flaws in some newer double-walled storage tanks at Washington State's Hanford Nuclear Waste Complex, which could lead to additional leaks. According to documents obtained by the Associated Press, and KOMO says that these tanks hold some of the worst radioactive waste in the nation's most contaminated nuclear site. One of the 28 giant underground tanks was found to be leaking in 2012, but subsequent surveys, they write, of other double-walled tanks performed for the U.S. DOE by one of its Hanford contractors found at least six shared defects with leaking tank that could lead to future leaks. I don't know where these leaks are. I suspect towards the bottom. There is a mechanism where if there is a crack in the bottom of the tank and it is in a place where the automated sweep doesn't move it, it could accumulate the heavier elements in the tank and widen the crack after becoming critical and causing neutron bombardment. This stuff is... There's still some mysteries as to how huge tanks like that with radioactive materials of various densities act. And, well, it's dangerous. But here's a quote from, if I may take a line from Forbes... with their banana dose equivalent article. Here's a line from that screaming and shouting usual suspect, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, wrote last Friday in a letter to Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, quote, "It is time for the Department of Energy to stop hiding the ball and pretending that the situation at Hanford is being effectively managed," end quote. Thank you, Ron Wyden. As I said, you're listening to Press Watch, KBOO Portland. Ukraine was offered $35 billion from Russia. Now the U.S. is offering $1 billion, and the European Union is offering $1.6 billion. There are gas lines crisscrossing Ukraine and Crimea, and that's what this crisis is about. But there are people in the way of what's going on. And as I mentioned last week, there are ideological Nazis in charge of the army in the new Ukrainian government. Now, that doesn't mean they're all Nazis, but I can't think of a worse place for the Nazis to be. And so I've been looking to find out what it could possibly mean that this is going on. From Haaretz, February 22nd, they wrote, "The Jewish Agency will extend immediate emergency assistance to the Jewish community of Ukraine, will help secure Jewish institutions in the country." According to Chairman Nathan Sharansky, Sharansky did not specify what form the assistance will take. Jewish leaders in Ukraine have voiced concerns about the community's security due to current uprising and violence of the last few days. Again, this is from February 22nd. And they said that a week before that, Ukrainian Rabbi Moshe Reuven Asman called on Kyiv's Jews to leave the city and even the country if possible. And the quote is, "I told my congregation to leave the city center or the city altogether, and if possible, the country too," end quote. That's Rabbi Asman telling Ma'ariv publication, Israeli Daily. He said, "I don't want to tempt fate, but there are constant warnings considering intentions to attack Jewish institutions." And Haaretz, also wrote, "The Ukrainian Jewish community is one of the largest in the world, with some 200,000 members. Most Jews reside in the capital, Kyiv, and there are thriving communities in Odessa, Lvov, and Dnipropetrovsk." Say that three times quickly. From JNS.org, the Jewish community in the Ukraine, is feeling the strain of the country's revolution, according to local Rabbi Moshe Reuven Asman. Quoting, "The situation in the Jewish community is very tense." He said, "We are on the brink of war with Russia, and people are being called up to recruitment centers. Among them are also Jews who are supposed to be drafted to the Ukrainian army. It is not a simple situation." Now, this is from the 3rd, a couple days ago. Currently, the Ukrainians are most concerned about a possible violent outbreak in the Crimean Peninsula. Asman, who is in contact with the Jewish community in conflict zone, said, quote, "There's tension there, and the situation is not easy. With God's help, we will overcome this situation and make it through." Now, compare and contrast that with what you're hearing on NPR, and you will know why I sometimes call it National Pentagon Radio. There's some question as to how intense anti-Semitic activity is, but really, if you read around it, it's not a question at all that there is anti-Semitic activity. And of course, Right Sector and Svoboda are virulent anti-Semitic organizations. Michael Chusadovsky on globalresearch.ca wrote, "Ironically, while the Israeli media dismisses the matter, the Arab media has provided a far more balanced assessment of the threat to the Jewish community in Ukraine. Rabbis in Kyiv and across Ukraine spoke out, warning their congregations to stay off the streets and remain in their homes. The Jewish agency in Jerusalem moved swiftly to offer aid to elderly Jews living in Greater Kyiv. Food delivery men are braving gunshots and Molotov cocktails to help them. Reports from Kyiv say the police have been replaced by roving bands of undetermined loyalty." And they write, "The fresh report of the firebombing of a new synagogue in Zaporizhia, 250 miles southeast of Kyiv, increased the alarm in Israel and accelerated planning for all contingencies, including evacuations." And that last part is a quote from Michael Chusadovsky from Al Jazeera, and that was on February 25th. So, and there is more information in that line. If I can find it just real quickly, from jpost.com, Jerusalem Post. "Several religious leaders in Ukraine, including Chief Rabbi and President of the Jewish Federation of Ukraine, Yaakov Dov Blake, called on Russia to stop its aggression against Ukraine and pull out its troops. And the letter also appealed to the international community to stop the foreign invasion into Ukraine and brutal interference in our internal affairs." So you have a different line there from Rabbi Blake. Alexander Baroda, president of Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia, told J-Post by phone on Monday that Rabbi Blake's entreaties were counterproductive, stating that the current conflict in Crimea is not connected to the Jews. Baroda declared that Jews and rabbis should stay away from politics. So that's the Russian, or not the, but a Russian rabbi. And in that same article, say a senior leader of the Russian Jewish community has urged his Ukrainian co-religionists to remain silent regarding the Russian military's takeover of the Crimean Peninsula last week. Convoluted situation there, and not at all as calm as you might hear on NPR. It's 24 after. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. If you want to know what's going on in Venezuela, you won't get the straight story from the U.S. corporate media. When I listen to, and here again, when I listen to NPR on this, I'm reminded of so many times when there's reporting from Cuba, the first thing you see is an ancient 1950s American car. I've been to Cuba, been around, it's been a while, but it's been a long while. And it was 1996, and even back then, those cars were very rare, and they must be very, very hard to find now. The streets were overrun with Fiats at the time and various other cars, and you could see those old cars, a reflection of the embargo, of course. But the reporting on Venezuela is just as bad. And if you want to know what's going on, it helps to pull up VenezuelaAnalysis.com. That's Venezuela plus the word analysis, but it's run together. So it's VenezuelaAnalysis, if you like, .com. They have a story, 9 things you should know about Venezuela. And they start with, the student marches are from the right wing of the student movement. Although if I were to start the article, I'd probably start with, these are the same people who attempted the coup in 2002. They really are. But anyway... from their article, unlike in places like Chile, they write, there is no single or united student movement in Venezuela. Not only are students' groups highly decentralized, but they are also divided along political lines. Another unique feature of the student groups identifying with the opposition is that they do not organize around accessible or free education, since education has been made accessible to the sector of society that was previously excluded, resulting in an increase of 1.8 million secondary students. The most recent opposition student demonstrations began in the western city of Táchira, near the Colombian border. On the third day of student demonstrations about insecurity on campus, the state governor's house was attacked. 4 people were subsequently arrested, 2 of whom weren't students. These arrests led to student demonstrations in other cities. And all of these demonstrations were not shut down by police, which led to the February 12th demonstration where 3 people died. On February 12th, however, it is important to know that there were thousands of Bolivarian students and youth marching for El Dia de la Juventud on the other side of Caracas. When speaking about student movement, the logical question is, which has to follow is, which one? Second, they say most have died due to violence and sabotage of the far-right protesters. And number gains with death of people, they write, is unpleasant. However, given how much of the coverage around the violence has been presented as direct state violence against peaceful protests, an account of how the violence was played out is necessary. Of the now 13 deaths directly resulting from the protests, at least 5 of the deaths have occurred at the barricades erected by the protesters, the right-wing protesters, at different sites, including motorcyclists who have been decapitated by barbed wire booby traps set up. And third, they write, there's been massive media manipulation. I'm not going to read most of this article because I'm getting close to the bottom of the hour. Fourth, there has been an active campaign to sabotage the Venezuelan economy. Fifth, crime is a regional problem and the opposition doesn't pose solutions. And sixth, the claims of state repression and media censorship are at best exaggerated, and that there's a lot to say about that. Certainly, well, exaggerated, and I don't have time to go into that, but what all this is reminding me of, you'll have to find the 7th, 8th, and 9th yourself at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. What this is reminding me of is the news that is just now coming out in the last couple of hours that the snipers who shot so many people in Kyiv apparently were set up by the protesters. So you can find more on that simply by searching the news and by taking NPR with a grain of salt. You're listening to Press Watch. Stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine here on KBOO Portland and all the ships at sea.
Proud to co-sponsor the 24th annual Cascade Festival of African Films. Due to cancellations of screenings due to the weather earlier this month, the festival is being extended through March 8th. please check their website for all scheduling details. AfricanFilmFestival.org.
Thank you to the following Portland restaurants for helping us out with our March 1st open house, 5th Quadrant, located at 3901 North Williams Avenue, and Escape from New York, 622 Northwest 23rd Avenue. Thanks for your help.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire, and today we're going to try and make a little more sense out of what's going on in Ukraine. And I'm going to pick up where Teresa left off. I've been listening to the news a lot, and I have to say that NPR's coverage was just abysmal. It was so one-sided. It was just... I don't have a TV, so I miss out on Fox News and CNN and all that. I get my news from KBOO, and I get my news from NPR, and I get my news from the internet. And NPR was so grotesquely one-sided. And two examples. A Morning Edition, they had a reporter, Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, who was in Kiev talking with the protesters. Which is, you know, fair enough. I mean, that's the story she is covering. So she presented their view. Then the host, Steve Inskeep, said, now let's get a view from Moscow. And I thought, okay, we'll get a balance. No, they got some woman from the Carnegie Institute in Moscow. The phone line was garbled, and so was her message. And she was mainly sort of psychoanalyzing Putin and everything. And well, that was. And then a couple days later, on All Things Considered, they had another story from the streets of Kiev, the protesters' version. And then the host, Robert Siegel, said, "Well, now let's get a viewpoint from Eastern Ukraine." Well, who did they get? They got some guy from one of those NGOs who was basically saying pretty much the same thing as the Western powers. So this is their idea of coverage. It's only it was like a flood of officials, former officials, think tank people, all supporting this sort of Washington consensus. It was unbelievable. It was really bad. And then finally, only on Tuesday, did I hear an interview with a man from a Russian think tank, and he gave their point of view. Now, that was on Tuesday. That was several days after this thing started, and presumably he was available all along. They could have had him before, but they didn't. Well, what happened in Kiev? For one thing, and nobody is denying this, President Viktor Yanukovych was democratically elected. No one is disputing that. He also had the authority to turn, as president, he had the authority to turn down the European Union offer and instead accept the deal with the Russians, which, as far as I can see, was a better deal, but it was his authority. What happened then was these protests started in the streets of Kiev. Protesters took over government buildings. They were in there, rampaging through offices. No denying that. Question is, if that happened in this country, would we allow that to happen? I don't think so. Then you had violence from both sides. And it's hard to, it's kind of not, it's sort of overlooked is that I believe 13 police were shot dead in the violence. Now, would we allow that in this country? What would we do if that happened here? You also had U.S. politicians in the street. I think John McCain was over there. And then you had Victoria Nuland giving away cookies, Would we allow that if, say the Iranians or Russians showed up at one of the Occupy Wall Street gatherings and started talking with the, supporting the more violent protesters and giving away pierogies or something? Would we allow that? No. No, we would not. Well, then after that, after this outbreak of violence, the protest leaders, the three main leaders, official leaders, and President Yanukovych reached a truce. And the truce was that protests would be allowed, and the protesters would stop attacking the police. Also, opposition politician Yulia Tymoshenko was freed from prison. The government was switched to a parliamentary government, and there would be elections in May, and Yanukovych resigned. That's what the Yanukovych and the three protest leaders agreed to. But apparently that was not good enough for the right-wingers, this Pravi Sektor, which is the extreme right-wingers, and then there's the Svoboda Party, which is almost as extreme. And then picking up on what Teresa mentioned about the who were these snipers? Well, there was a very interesting story. This is on Russia Today, so consider the source and check it out yourself. You can find it. What happened was apparently the government of the Ukraine, the Yanukovych government, hacked into a phone call from European Union Foreign Affairs leader Catherine Ashton, and she was talking with the Foreign Affairs Minister of Estonia, and they were talking about what was going on in, and I heard that you could get it on, it's on the internet, and they have you can hear the recordings, you hear the voice.